So more than marrying across racial lines, or marrying across religious lines, or marrying across economic lines, Americans are becoming more and more loath to marry across political lines, or even to have roommates across political lines. If you are a liberal Democrat, your ideal roommate is a Jewish person who votes Democrat and listens to hip-hop, according to recent statistics. And your least preferred would be, I think, a Republican who hunts. So we don't marry across lines of belief, nor do we room and live across lines of belief. Likewise, there is a segregation by zip code more and more. So much about a person's life can be predicted and predicated on their zip code. So we are just entered the month of Av. We're in the 3 weeks of mourning that precede the 9th of Av, and then 6 days later, the 15th of Av, which is a Jewish day of romance and celebration. So I want to read to you a passage from Talmud Ta'anit about that. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, there never were in Israel greater days of joy than the 15th of Av and Yom Kippur. The anonymous writer of the Mishnah, the Gemara rather, says, I can understand Yom Kippur, because that's the day of forgiveness and pardon. Just an unusual paradox. Yom Kippur is both a day of inui nefesh, which is to say, thrashing the soul, but also a day of great celebration, because we know that ultimately we will be relieved of the burden of our transgressions. And on it, the second tablets of the law were given, but what happened on the 15th of Av? And Rabbi Yehuda replies in the name of Shmuel, it's the day on which permission was granted to the tribes to intermarry. So Anna in the other room is having a wonderful discussion on egalitarianism, among other things, and Hogla, Milka, Mochla, Noah, and Tirza, who were the daughters of Tzlofechad, and the ways in which distribution of land was required at that period, but later on, according to this Midrash from Talmud, there would be permission given to intermarry. So as I've been suggesting more and more recently and struggling with both internally and publicly, with the rise of sectarianism in our community and elsewhere, as far flung as Poland and as near as Knox County. And our sages were not unaware of such things. Although, frankly, the Bible is presented both as a sectarian affair and a sectional affair, which is to say, sectional in the way that the Civil War broke out, where you have divisions by region, which we have less and less so, or at least our divisions are largely urban versus rural. But they saw the prescribed genocide of this week's parasha as deeply problematic. And you have as recently as the Ma'amar Hechaltzu, which is a Hasidic teaching from the turn of the 20th century, a commentary on the destruction of Midian that makes somewhat allegorical the problem. The Hebrew Midian, he says, means strife. Midian is the essence of divisiveness, which is the root of all evil. So our sages speak of sinat chinam, groundless hatred, as the greatest of evil. Yet in truth, all strife is groundless. I don't like to make, don't have too much truck with the idea that Judaism is a universal or universalizing religion. It's not. It is just as chauvinistic as any other religion can be. But there is a countervailing trend of understanding that all human beings are created in the image of God and that each has inestimable worth, whatever color, nation, creed they subscribe to or ascribe to, whatever their beliefs within certain reasonable bounds. But this challenge that I've been bringing to you recently, and I'm sure will arrive again over the holidays in my discourses, of the zealotry that seems to be infecting the body politic and the divisiveness, the midyan, the strife, the sectarianism, and to an extent, sectionalism, and the complete dissociation of various political parties and various beliefs, it's still rough. And Moses, you know, I still don't understand why he's described as the most humble of all persons, because simultaneously he's the most zealous and aggressive and even arrogant of all persons. I feel like it's like, you know, calling a bald fellow curly. Like they're trying to insist, it's trying to tell, not show, that he is humble. Unless anavut meant something else. Because in the Midrash on this parsha, we get a quote in Numbers 31 that after the destruction of Midian will come Moses' death. That's the final act of his life. And roughly true, the next parsha is the beginning of Deuteronomy, which is his sort of final soliloquy to the people, his valedictory address, his pre-death address. And we're told that after the destruction of Midian, he'll be gathered to his people. So the Midrash notes, oh man, that would have been a good opportunity to do nothing. As Woody Allen said, I don't want to be immortal for my art. I want to be immortal because I don't die, right? Like Moses could have just done nothing. And there were, you know, there is this dogma that he would have to precede his death with this genocide. And he could hold off for a number of reasons and live forever. But he doesn't. He does it with zeal. In spite of all that, he enters into it with zeal, which to me suggests not necessarily a humbleness, but a zealotry, like the zealotry we talked about with Pinchas and Elijah. I think it was in last week's Dvar Torah I talked about that. Pardon? Okay. Oh, okay. Sasirat Kiddush. And again, as I discussed about ambivalence last week, there is contained in our Midrashim, in our rabbinic tellings of the parasha, a value, a measure of ambivalence. So we got chapters and books ago in a Midrash, the idea that Moses is hesitant to curse the Nile River because that's what saved him. He was set in the Nile River by his sister and set down the river and watched by his sister, rather, and that saved him from the Pharaoh's decree. So he's reluctant to harm the Nile River with the curse, I think, of blood. And likewise, in this parasha, we get the same thing. So the Midrash says, Moses notes that Moses sent Pinchas and others to do the act of violence against the Midianites. Why? Because the Midrash also understands him to be zealous in the performance of mitzvot, that he quickly acts in God's name. He had grown up there. And it was the place of his childhood and the place where he met his wife, in the place of his father-in-law, and he said, it is not right that I should punish one who has done good to me. The proverb says, a well from which you drank, cast not a stone in it. Again, like the Nile. I think we could all imagine that tension. It's hard to reject those that have loved us. It's hard to act against those who have cared for us and whose care has shown true. It's hard for the mini narcissist in all of us to disagree with or to recognize the problems of someone who has been kind to us. It's just human nature. But I want to take that in a slightly different or broader direction, that I think even Moses here recognizes this is not going to be easy, nor should it be. Like the idea of the Midian, the idea of strife, of sectarianism, of divisiveness, drawing those boundaries, and we get also in the parasha issues of boundaries for the land of Israel, drawing boundaries of any sort is always a fraught experience. And the boundaries that are being drawn in our country and communities and that are being made thicker and thicker and more impermeable by the day, we should be deeply ambivalent about that. Sometimes, as Frost would say, walls make good neighbors. And sometimes they're just a problem. So we should approach those walls skeptically. And the walls of intermarriage between Republicans and Democrats, which is a statistic that's on my mind, but all those walls we build up against and between the people with whom we associate, who we will talk to, who we will have open conversation with, who will be on our sports teams, those are dangerous walls. and there are fewer and fewer places where those walls are broken down. I would see them when I worked in the field in 12-step groups. You can see them on sports teams. But there are fewer and fewer places where people of different economic status, racial background, and political leaning associate. Those places are quite precious. How do we begin to knock down walls? There is question in the parsha about two issues, one of besieging a city in war and another of the cities of refuge. So the first is self-explanatory. The cities of refuge were the three and then six cities set up for a manslaughter to retreat to, lest he be followed and become part of an ongoing blood vendetta. In contradistinction to what Jack said, I understand that to be about preventing vendetta. You know, in ancient times, where justice can be rough, the main source of justice is killing people who hurt your cousin. I mean, you know, you gather a group of your family members and go out to murder the person who harmed your cousin. Still happens in Papua New Guinea. And those levels of internecine violence are actually outstrip on a per capita basis even World War II. So that it was recognized that in early time, this is problematic for a city. We need to create escape valves. So that's the cities of refuge. And Maimonides talks about in the era of siege, and I don't know if this is still or was in later military strategy, but Maimonides in the Laws of Kings says that if you were to siege a city to conquer it, you don't surround it on all four sides, but only from three sides. And I think Sun Tzu would say things like this too, leaving a way for anyone to escape who wishes to flee for his life. In terms of military strategy, I think the point there is if you start to besiege, make the siege too complete, people start to go insane and do dangerous things, and it could actually rebound badly on your army. And you want to create a valve for people to break down and escape. If the only alternative is death, people will fight to the death. But the idea of making a three-quarters boundary sounds very nice. You know, I'm not suggesting we tolerate white supremacy. I am suggesting that there are many people whom we have written off on all sides of all political arguments, on all sides of racial divides, on all sides of geographic divides that need a window, that need a door, that need the walls broken down. And I don't have a particular place where you draw that line. I don't know which wall you knock down of the four. But I know that this complete exclusion is really toxic. And it's leading our country in a way that causes me deep fear and grief. And years ago on the holidays, I talked to you about a metaphor that a Christian colleague in town made through about Australian shepherding, the image of wells and fences. So in Europe, they fenced in pastures. Let out your sheep. You knew exactly where they were. It was in a fenced-in area. This is not, exclude the Middle East from this argument. In Australia, the open lands are much larger. Logistically impossible, relatively impossible to fence in. So what they do there is they keep wells and water holes. And the animals stay relatively close to the wells and water holes. So years ago when I gave this sermon, I talked about that as a model for congregational life, that in many places in religious life, we have created exclusionary boundaries. You can't come in if you're not Jewish, simplest one. Whereas the way forward is to create dig wells and to create methods and places of deep attraction to a religious system. That was what I talked about then. But there's got to be a similar parable for civic life as well. So Maimonides, when he talks about the construction of these cities of refuge, and he's writing in the roughly 11th century, and he's writing a law code rather than a descriptive narrative and prescriptive document like the Torah. So Maimonides says clearly and explicitly, a court is obligated to straighten the roads to the cities of refuge, to repair them, to broaden them. They must remove all impediments and obstacles, build bridges over natural barriers, and not so as not to delay anyone fleeing the city, creating the Roman road to these cities of refuge. The width of a road to a city of refuge should not be less than 32 cubits, which is 40 or 50 feet wide. I'm in a, you know, effectively a Roman road. Refuge, refuge was written at all crossroads so that murderers would recognize the way and turn there. Lest you think we don't have a parable of the prodigal son in our community, there's one. No matter how far you've gone, no matter how far astray a person is from your belief and practice, there should always be a route for you to get back to them. My mother used to be quite anxious that my sister and I would never speak again after a certain age because our political views diverged. I don't know why she thought that. Our political views are fairly consonant. But I do know that happens in families. You know, I can think of one community family where I've been visiting and Fox News is on and another sibling comes in and says, "Oh, turn that off. Pardon?
That's also building barrier.
Right, that's my point. Siblings least of all, but as we would say, we're all siblings. Right? We are all part of the human family, and there should always be royal roads to return to each other. And as we are now, a little more than two months from Yom Kippur, this is a kind of tshuva as well. This is a kind of return and repentance as well. To allow each other to return in love, whatever our differences may be.